All right. Hello. Welcome back to another live stream, Next Stage Sessions. I'm Casey Lau. I'm the co-host of Web Summit, Collision, Rise, and all the great Web Summit conferences. And I guess every other week we're doing these kind of live streams with some of our speakers to talk a little bit about what they're working on. You know, when you go to Web Summit, it's a very short talk time. And so I wanted to dig a little bit deeper. And we also wanted to bring some of the startups that exhibit at our event to kind of get some one-on-one time with some of these amazing founders that we have speaking at the show. And today, well, this is the hottest topic right now, next to AI. I'd say this is the next hottest topic, right? Social media, with all the Twitter or rather X type talk, where you have Gabor, the CEO and co-founder of T2 in the house. Gabor, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
All right. It's great. So Gabor came out to Collision in May and was talking on stage, center stage, with Stephen Levy, the super trooper of journalists, about T2. And we gave out a lot of accounts to the audience there, and I was lucky enough to get one as well and start playing around with it. As soon as that happened, like a couple weeks later, Threads shot out, Twitter changed the name to X. It's a whole gigantic, crazy, I don't know, what do you call this? It's like a short form text social media wars going on. So it's very exciting. But before we get into that, Gabor, you know, you have done, is it two or three startups in the past?
This is my third, yeah.
This is your third startup. And so that's why I think it's great to have you on the show today. So we can talk a little bit about building startups in Silicon Valley and, you know, really going like this is not just another, not a new type of idea. You're going after some huge, huge companies with T2. So let's start from the beginning. You started off, I was looking at your bio and you started at Google working on Android. Right. So you have a lot of a mobile experience from the past. Is there anything you can share with us that won't get you into trouble? That's like, you know, stuff about Android that you learned while working in mobile in terms of usage or anything like that. Wow, this is really cool information.
Yeah. Wow. This takes me way back. So actually, my very first job, quote unquote, was I was an intern at Google right around the time that they IPO'd in 2004. And I was working on Gmail, not Android. Wow. Later, I get to work on Gmail and Android, kind of tying the two together. But I was an intern with Paul Buchheit, who was the inventor of Gmail. And my intern task was, please implement attachment preview. So if you go into your Gmail and you see a little attachment preview at the bottom of your email, I wrote the very first version of that as an intern in 2004.
And wow.
Gmail back then was a super small team. Now it's like hundreds of people working on it. And really that felt just like such a magical moment. Went back to school, got my master's, wrote my master's thesis about sort of what I guess now I would pitch as AI for email, but back then it was a bit more pedestrian. Then went back to Google. I worked as a product manager later on Gmail and Android, on Inbox as well, which some of you remember. Yeah. The two startups, one of which I sold to Google, the other one I sold to Twitter, which has how the whole T2 story started. And then also I oversaw new product incubation at Google in their incubator called Area 120, where I oversaw 22 different startup-like projects. So I have a fair bit of 0-to-1 experience.
Exactly. When I saw this, I'm like, oh, this is what we're going to talk about. There's such great stuff here. Okay, so you worked on the Gmail stuff. So is that what Remail is? It's like you learned a lot of stuff. You saw some holes in it. You thought this is a good idea to start this startup around and call Remail.
Oh, my goodness. So this is Y Combinator 2008. I was in the same batch as Airbnb.
Okay, wow.
It was pretty clear pretty early on that my startup wasn't going to be the top startup in the batch. Right. So it was Brian. Eventually, it stopped even showing up to the Tuesday meetings because they just got money from Sequoia and they just started taking off. The insight was, wow, the iPhone just launched. Well, that wasn't the original insight. After a pivot, the insight was, well, the iPhone just launched and they just launched the API for the iPhone or the SDK. And you know what the iPhone doesn't have is email search. You have email, but you can't search it. And people really need to search their email. So we're just going to build an email client with search built in. And that's what Remail was. This is like 2010.
Wow.
And you made the search really, really fast by caching all of your email on your device. And that was a cool technology. And then Google called me and said, hey, we're building mobile email experiences. This is like back in 2010, and we'd love to have you and your team join us. So we got acquired as a smaller talent acquisition to Google.
Wow, that's amazing. I was just watching the BlackBerry movie. That iPhone sure had a lot of repercussions around it, right? For the positive and the negative. So that's quite interesting. So tell me, like, do you think, and this is something, because I'm not in Silicon Valley, but do you think you have a bit of an unfair advantage in this? Because, you know, you're making something that you obviously know that Google needs, and it was an easy way to exit out of the company. Do you think that startups that are here have that kind of advantage over startups in other countries?
It's hard to say. I would say, I think that it was a particular moment in time, right? It was a moment in time when Google had, we just come out of the great financial crisis of 2008. Google had stopped hiring, and then Google said, okay, we're going to hire again, and we're going to look at some talent acquisitions we're going to just look at a lot of them and buy a lot of these smaller startups for the talent. So that's how we got acquired. And I had known, I had those previous contacts from Google, and those are really obviously very, very helpful in getting that company acquired. So it was a particular moment in time. I don't think that moment in time is right now. M&A is like at an all-time low, or maybe getting unfrozen again. But it definitely helps to have the contacts with your professional, maybe with your potential acquirer from earlier in your career.
Well, I'm definitely spending more time in the Bay Area now, and I'm seeing if you are an AI startup, there's really nowhere else to go. If you're not here, I think you're going to lose a lot of network. You're going to lose a lot of investor connections. You're going to lose a lot of staffing connections. I think it's just like so hot here. So I'm sure it was like that back 10 years ago, right? For what you guys, for all the YC network and things like that.
Yeah, for sure. I think here also in the Bay Area, M&A is a tool that people know about versus I was working for a little while. I was working at Google in Zurich, and Google has acquired maybe one or two companies in Europe. Or in Switzerland specifically, because it's not thought of as a tool to really build your talent or build out your organization. Here, it's much more of a thing that happens.
And when you say here, do you mean Silicon Valley? Or do you mean the US?
So I am in Berkeley, California. So that is the Bay Area. It would be presumptuous of me to say, oh, it's the entire US, because I know the scene here, and here definitely M&A is a much more tool than else.
Okay, that's interesting. Very interesting. Okay, so now you move on to work at Twitter, right? You're the group product manager at Twitter, working on growth. But you got into Twitter because you started another startup called Namo Media, right? And you co-founded that in 2014, and you got M&A'd again into that, right?
M&A'd again, yeah.
Talk a little bit about how did you start Namo, and then how did you get involved with Twitter there?
Yeah, that was nuts. So I left Google in 2012, and I said, I'm going to try to do the startup thing again. But I'm first going to really work on the idea. And I initially worked on a consumer social idea that would be like, I would call it like WhatsApp with drawing or something like that. It was the idea that you could collaboratively draw with your friends on your phone. It was a stupid idea. It was also a way for me to work with a potential co-founder that I was thinking about maybe starting a company with. Honestly, it didn't really work out. And also the idea didn't really work out. But in the end, we did this thing, which is like, we're going to auction off the IP. So we have this app, and we want to auction it off. And this company in Kansas City bought it that was making apps for Android and for iOS. And we flew out to Kansas City to sort of hand over this thing to them. And they said, so we make all these apps and we monetize them with ads. And the ad format back then was 320 by 50 pixel sort of banner ads that most people clicked on accidentally. And they were like, this isn't really working for us because the money we make with this is decreasing. We're making less revenue every month. And so I said, Okay, wait a second. I just saw the Facebook quarterly earnings report come out. This was end of 2013, and they'd gone from zero to $151 million in mobile revenue by introducing native mobile ads. And I
Wow.
clicked those two things together and said, okay, we're going to do native mobile ads, NAMO Media, which was the name of the company, for apps that aren't Facebook and aren't Twitter. And this was very much like a moment in time. I believe these opportunities come in specific moments. And so we built that. It was the we started talking to publishers, started talking to advertisers. We raised money on in the very first pitch meeting with GV, Google Ventures, as the lead. And it was sort of off to the races. We built it as quickly as possible. And then eventually we started signing up all of these publishers of mobile apps before Twitter or Facebook could have their competitive solution. And then it basically kicked off a lot of interest in acquiring us. And then we sold to Twitter in June of 2014.
That you had an investment firm, Google Ventures, BetaWorks, and Andreessen for this
That's
startup.
right, yeah.
And then that's amazing. I mean, let's just go back a bit. So you did a startup, you sold it, you went to work for that company, and then you said, that's enough. I want to get back into the startup world. Is that, do you think that's a Bay Area thing? Do you think that just because all your friends in your network are talking about it, that you do it? Or do you think it's really the person that's like, I have to do this. I really believe in this concept that I'm building.
I think the Bay Area definitely makes it easier to do that because there's much more of a network of people doing it, and you're kind of the average of the people that surround you. So if a bunch of your friends are doing startups, then I think you're considering it more. The availability of capital also really helps. I do think it's possible outside the Bay Area as well. I think that is, and I think in some ways the talent pool is differently shaped, which we can talk about. In the Bay Area, it's really, really hard to actually hire people. So yeah, it was definitely a moment where I said, okay, I'm going to try to do this startup thing again. I don't have a great idea. The first idea turned out to be terrible, but the first idea led to a better idea, which then led to a much more significant acquisition by Twitter.
Amazing, amazing, incredible. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about your time at Twitter. So, were you a user before? Do you like the product? Because obviously you love the format since now you're doing T2, but talk a little bit about the Twitter experience.
Yes, I signed up for Twitter as soon as I could, and I got my first name on Twitter, which was great. And then in the early days of Twitter, it was really easy to get a bunch of followers. And so I said, wow, I have this audience. And I started kind of getting into it, and definitely loved to use Twitter as a product. Twitter acquired us, and initially I worked on ads. And I then said to the sort of VP product at the time, Kevin Weil, hey, could I please work on consumer? I really love consumer. I worked on Gmail before. Will you let me do it? And he said, sure, fine. And I went over to Twitter, the consumer app. And it was, so this was Dick Costolo was kind of like on his way out. He had maybe like 6 months left after I switched to consumer. Jack Dorsey came in. And it was honestly like a wild time at Twitter. I had within my last year at Twitter, I had six managers, one of whom I had for 2 hours before he left to work for Slack, which was like brilliant move. It was just a very difficult place to get anything done because there was so much churn and priorities and management. And even back then, I remember thinking, wow, I can't. This company would be like, this product is so magical, but why is this company not working?
Yeah. Amazing. Wow. So you've already explained the positive and negative of the Bay Area already in just like in 15 minutes. It's amazing. And then after Twitter, you go back to Google and you're running the Area 120 program project or department there. I've always fascinated by this when I found out that you were part of it. Can you talk a little bit about it? This is the group that helps the Googlers who are working for Google take 20% of their time to build their own projects, right? And you're helping them to launch and iterate these products. So you're like the internal accelerator for Google. Talk a little bit about how that worked, because you must have learned so much, because you have all these Google resources behind you and all these super smart people building stuff. Can you really build a startup in 20% of your time? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, so Area 120, like you said, the concept is we're going to allow Googlers to not spend 20% of their time, but 100% of their time on projects that they came up with themselves. So that's the 120. That's why it's called Area 120. I think the branding is maybe acts a bit more secretive than the actual organization ones instead of Google. So we're in like Skunkworks building, I don't know, flying objects in a garage in Mountain View. We were in a regular Google office with regular Googlers building regular Google products. So corporate incubation is a big problem because you need to come up with new ideas, you need to fund those ideas, and you need to empower people to actually execute on those ideas. And there's a couple of different ways to do it. There are, we took the position of, we're going to accept ideas from everyone inside of Google. We're going to look through them, we're going to vet them, and then we're going to take people out of the regular Google job that they had and put them into our group, and they get to work in small teams on these new products, and then we're going to let them actually publicly launch it. Yeah. There's other ways to do it. I would say that the complete opposite way to do it is, we're going to work on sort of crazy out there stuff with really talented people it's much more researchy. The idea is not to launch these products as standalone, but it is to build new technologies that could be foundational. And Google has that too. In Google Brain, for example, or Google Labs, which was launched a few years ago. So Google has a pretty wide net of strategies there. Each of those have pros and cons. I think what I learned, probably the key learnings from Area 120 for me were, one, good ideas can come from anywhere. And it's really inspiring to see how the most junior software engineer in Google Photos, like three layers deep in the Google Photos organization, can come up with a great idea.
Awesome.
The second one is that Google has a ton of infrastructure that makes 0-1 a lot easier, whether it's logging in with your Google login. Gives customers trust that this is safe and secure. You get access to data that you can use in the new product. You don't need to rebuild it from zero. So you're not starting from zero if you're incubating in a large company. And the last learning that I had was that I think the internal organizational dynamics, aka politics, of doing new product incubation in a large org can be very difficult and actually are a skill by itself that you need to build.
Wow, super interesting. We can talk more and more about this because I think that you've learned so much stuff. Okay, so at this point then, you were there for what, 6 years or so? And then I guess the startup itch comes around again, and then you leave and then you start to build T2. Can you talk a little bit about now the ideation process, since we want to focus the rest of the interview on T2? So how does it happen? Like, because Twitter is already way in the back window for you, but I guess you love it. You're using it still, and you probably see the problems with it that have happened since the transition. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I left Google in July of last year, and I initially went on sort of an ideas quest, kind of just like the last time that I left Google, which is like, what's going to be the idea here? And I wanted to do something consumer social because consumer social is just like so exciting for me. It was when I was working on Twitter, and then also when I was working on new consumer products at Google, it was just really exciting. And initially, I was very focused on short form video because that seemed to be the format of the day. And I was experimenting with all sorts of stuff and interviewing TikTok creators and trying to get in touch with a bunch of people that are producing podcasts or vodcasts and so on. So I went pretty deep on that space. And I was also trying to figure out who I wanted to start the company with. And I was sort of vetting different potential co-founders and I was going about that. In the back of my mind, there was always this thought, even when I was working at Twitter, of like, wow, this is just not that functional of a company. And this was Twitter under Dick Costolo and Jack Dorsey, which was arguably more functional than it is today. And so when Elon took over and that like first or second Friday laid off half the staff, I was like, wow, this is not going to go well.
Right.
Because you can't actually go and just fire half the people and expect that everything kind of works and clicks together as it did previously. And one of the people that he laid off was now co-founder, Sarah Oh, who was working on trust and safety at Twitter and previously had worked in similar roles at Facebook. And I had kind of I started then on Twitter. I was just going through my Twitter feed and I was like, there were people being like, why doesn't anyone build another Twitter? It should take 2 weeks. And then I said, actually, it won't take 2 weeks. And I put together a
Exactly.
Google sheet with a roadmap of like how you would rebuild something that was kind of equivalent to Twitter. And I posted that on Twitter. I got
Yeah, you
like
put it on
thousands
Twitter,
of likes
right?
and tweets.
Yeah.
And the way that resonated really made me take that seriously because all of the previous short form video ideas that I had were like, people were like, yeah, whatever, it's fine. Like, I can get this on TikTok. And this
Right.
one really resonated. And so I called Sarah and was like, well, I think trust and safety needs to be a big part of this. And that's really your area of expertise and not my area of expertise. And she said, okay, well, I consider maybe coming aboard. And she became my co-founder. And later we also got Michael Greer to join us, who is our CTO, and he came from Discord. So we had a great kind of founding team
Wow.
together, and then we just kind of kicked it off from there.
Okay, so let's hold there. Wow, that's amazing. So this is probably the easiest, cheapest MVP ever created, right? And it's posting on your soon-to-be competitor's platform.
That's
And
right.
of course, but also being in the Bay Area, you can assemble an incredible team that investors will just flock to quite quickly. So this is last year. It's still kind of a down market last year. Was it easy to raise? Did you raise? Was it easy to raise? Is it?
No.
What? What? Yeah. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so I think that there, so at this point, I had a Google Sheet, I had a wait list, I had Sarah, and I had no code, no users. And my initial plan said, we're going to need like $12 million and we're going to need 7 months to build like an MVP of this. And I think in retrospect, it was quite a bad plan. But so I went and pitched a couple of VCs, and universally, the feedback was, one, you don't really have anything. Two, we love you, Gabor, but this is like a big mountain to climb. And three, we think that Elon is actually pretty great, and it's going to be really hard to compete with him.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, so I mean, I think they were right on all those three counts because we didn't
Yeah.
really have anything.
Yeah.
Elon is, I think he's executed worse than VCs expected, honestly.
Exactly.
Maybe all of us expected, but TBD, maybe the X thing is like a master, like a genius thing that I can't quite read. But universally, the feedback was extremely skeptical. So I was like, okay, this is not going to be one of those things where I pitch like one VC and get a term sheet immediately. And then I went all the way back to YC. And the first thing that Paul Graham would always tell you, and there's if you go to Y Combinator's website, there's the essential Y Combinator advice. And the first thing they say is launch now. So I said, okay, let's go back to the drawing board and let's figure out how to like launch this something, anything in 2 weeks. And we did on December 9th launch t2.social to 5 users. Actually, six. I just recounted. We had at the end of the day 6 users, and we started learning. So we built like this Vue.js Nuxt app just as quickly as possible, and launched that. And then we started learning, and that has been, I think, a really, really good approach because it both said that we're serious, and also we actually got to learn and onboard some users, and really make a lot of progress from there.
Yeah, that's amazing. But by December, Mastodon is already out there. Blue Sky is already out there. Did you know about these things? These are all in Bay Area as well, right? So they're all out there. Your investors must know that you're going to be running up against these guys. How do you see that? I mean, I don't want to say anything negative, but when you see them, what do you think? Are they doing similar things that you are doing, you think, or do you think of a different strategy in this space?
Yeah, so I think that there are, I mean, there's essentially two different approaches. One is the sort of centralized approach that we're taking, which is we're going to have a central team that is doing trust and safety. We're going to have a central namespace where you can have your handle. And that's how we're going to kind of operate the network. And we, as the, you know, corporation, take ultimate responsibility for running it. And that is the approach that X, aka Twitter, has, that Threads has, and that we have. And then there's the distributed approach, which is Mastodon. I believe that's actually based in Germany, not in the Bay Area. Blue Sky, which is, I think, West Coast based. I'm not sure if they're in the Bay Area or not. They're both distributed networks. Blue Sky has one sort of major instance that the corporation runs, and I'm not aware of any others, but I may be wrong. And Mastodon is actually pretty distributed. And I think it's going to be hard. I think we're already seeing the shortcomings of the distributed approach, because I'm sure you've seen the headlines about people operating Mastodon instances, and then you get sort of pornography, yeah, or even worse, child sexual abuse material, CSAM, on there, and you are ultimately responsible for taking that down, legally responsible for taking that down as quickly as possible. So it really puts a lot of burden on the people operating these Mastodon instances. And I think that is a, that burden outweighs the benefits of the kind of larger ownership of your data and larger ownership of your own instance that otherwise you would have.
That's what I think people don't understand. I think Reddit is seeing this now, right? It's like, if you have it too decentralized, people, we don't know what's going on these things. We don't know how to control it, things like that. I think people take it for granted. Like, I mean, I love the Web3 things, and some of the startups we're going to bring on in Web3 and having, you know, ownership of all your stuff is very important. But at the same time, yeah, there's a lot of stuff. I've seen all this stuff on Mastodon and Blue Sky. I was like, whoa, this is, how do you, and then your co-founder was doing this at Twitter. You know, how do you guys are looking at all this content moderation, this illicit material? It's like something nobody talks about, right? I mean, I remember reading a Wired article about Facebook, how many people they have on their teams just to get rid of all this bizarre material, not bizarre, but, you know, negative material. Yeah. I mean, and obviously Twitter is famous for having this crazy stuff on it. Like, how do you guys look at that? And how important is it to be, you know, how do you sit? Like, how do you make it free speech, but you also, you know, don't want make it too, like, you know, illegal?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think this is where AI comes in. And so I think the, so social media 1.0, I would say, was, if there's an issue, there's a little ... menu, and then there's a flag or report icon, and then there's the people manually looking at these reports and then taking content down, both for copyright violation and also for terms of service or community guidelines violations. That was kind of the olden days. That was sort of like the end of the 2000s era, with a lot of manual trust and safety methods. I think that what has been possible recently in the last couple of years is to have, obviously, AI read every single post, scan every single image, and then flag it for manual review, or even proactively take it down if the signal is really strong. What we are now additionally doing with T2 is we built these nudges. So if you are on T2 and you start typing something that we believe will be in violation of the community guidelines, like you're, for example, making threats or you're disclosing personal information, then we will pop up a little nudge in the actual Compose experience to say, you probably shouldn't post this. So moving from like a very reactive social media 1.0 approach to a much more proactive approach that is powered by AI. I think that's one of the key components where AI can really help.
Let's bring up the T2 site now, in case some people haven't seen it yet, because I don't think everybody can see it. Here's your profile, Gabor. I went to it. So maybe walk us a little bit through. I'll scroll through it while you talk about it. I mean, it looks very similar to Twitter. You got your headshot. You got who's following you. You're also, oh, there's the authentication. That was also something interesting. You're using a third party for that. And then the little bio, and then, you know, where you're based and website link. Talk a little bit about, you know, the look and feel is going to be very familiar, I guess, because you're trying to show that this is another version of the other platform. And also, you added DMs into it, right? That was the big thing.
Yeah,
that you
that's right. In. Yeah, I think it's exactly what you said. It's the familiar format, a familiar place, but I guess not branded X, not branded Twitter. And you can see it's pretty conversational, just like Twitter was. You can see the replies coming in, and there's a fair amount of activity on my profile. Some of these I didn't even read yet. So on the left side, you see home, notifications, profile, DMs, which we just added, and our invites tab, so you can invite other people and kind of get that some of that viral growth to go. But this is essentially kind of the idea was to create a familiar format, a familiar place, and then keep adding to that. So we just launched DMs last Wednesday. That was one of our most requested features. And I think it's really important for a kind of a public square type product to also have a private channel where you can communicate. So that's been really successful. But this is very much the idea that we had, is to recreate the feel and the magic of Twitter.
Amazing. And then is it open to the public now, or do you have to get on a wait list still?
It's not open to the public yet. You have to get on the wait list, but I was going to wait for this for until a little bit later. I will drop shortly once I need to copy out a little link, and I will drop in a little invite for everyone that's listening today just join right now.
Awesome. I'm on here, Sosa Collision, Web Summit. We all have the profiles on here. I find it definitely a lot more relaxing and calm than some of the other ones. People are very friendly on it, like actually friendly. So I definitely, because when I see this launch and these other ones launch, I'm like, why do we need another one? But I can definitely feel like, and this is my next question to you, is like, you know, with social media, I feel like I have a different persona on Instagram, a different persona on Facebook. Yeah, I still use Facebook. I have a lot of old friends on there. So yeah, that's a different one. Instagram, of course, is very visual. And then Twitter is like almost 100% Web3. If I post anything else on there, it gets no traction. If it's something to do with Web3 stuff, it's always very popular. And then LinkedIn, where I'm streaming this live on my own personal feed, as well as the Web Summit Collision feed, it's another audience as well. So I guess, do you see this as well? Do you think that T2 and these other social, social platforms can have this kind of same effect? Like people want to see, have a different group of friends or a different group of network on each of these different platforms.
Yeah, I think we're seeing the early beginnings that are already on T2. I would say our audience is very tech forward, and you'll see people talking about tech, talking about AI, I think is a big topic these days on T2. Yeah. So it's definitely become a little bit of a very tech-centric community, partially because our big moment of invites was also the Collision Conference this year. So I think over 1,000 people from the audience joined on within an hour that day. So that kind of has shaped the community. I do think that there is a space for multiple places. Like I think there's the LinkedIn sort of thought leadership and let me talk about my career. Facebook has kind of become more your family. And the demographics maybe of Facebook has also aged a little bit. Twitter, I think, is very dependent on who your followers are and what sort of like the algorithm picks up and how it distributes your content. For me, it is obviously like very much like, what are we going to do about Twitter and X and Elon, et cetera?
Right.
It's kind of become that.
I don't see that stuff on mine. That's really weird. Unless Elon posts something, I look at the comments. Other than that, I don't see a debate about that, right? I see everything else except that. And I don't see a lot of the right-wing political stuff that people are always talking about. I guess it is based on like an algorithm and stuff, and it kind of floats me away from that and into more of these discussions on blockchain stuff, which I'm more fascinated with, right?
Yeah. It's the echo chamber algorithm approach.
Exactly. Sure. That's why I like TikTok, because they start feeding me just popular stuff. So I see like stuff I've never would see because it's just popular, but other people seem to like it. So maybe you might like it too, right? Mm-hmm.
So how do I drop my invite code in here? I see a is this no?
Okay, that's good. That's good enough. John will see that and he'll post it into the feeds. Thank you for that. Okay, so yeah, if you're watching this, if you're listening to us, but there it is. It's up there now. It's on all the platforms. In case you're just listening to this, It's t2.social/i/collision next with two N's. So take a look at that, but you'll see that out there. We're going to bring up some startups from some questions, but I just have a couple more last questions for you. So what do you as a startup founder do when Mark Zuckerberg launches a product that looks like it's trying to compete with you and is bragging about 100 million users in like hours or like days? What do you as a team see? And what do your investors think when they see something like this? I've always wanted to know, because this seems to be like, to me, like, if, like, you know, Web3, there was a big moment when the marketplace has lost their royalties thing. And so everybody who invested in a marketplace for NFTs went crazy, right? So how about, and so this, I don't know, to me, it would seem like, oh, what are we going to do now? But maybe for you, it's a calm moment. You're like, it's justify verifying what you're doing. I don't know. What's going through everybody's mind when this product gets launched?
Yeah. So I think step one is deep breath and you kind of go from there. And I think it's really important to not. Step two is probably, there's a Paul Graham essay about how most startups die by suicide and not murder. So it's not the competition that kills you. It's that you run out of funding typically, or there's some like co-founder infighting. Probably I've seen a lot of those. There's this beautiful book. I'm going to bring this. I brought a prop.
All right. Great. I love it. So,
I really recommend this book.
It's Cold Start Problem.
The Cold Start Problem by Andrew Chen.
Yeah.
I've read it. And so there's a chapter here about Big Bang launches. And this was, so I was at Google when Google Plus got launched. And what Google Plus was initially was, we're going to have a small community and it's going to be invite only, and we're going to, you can try it out. And that community really was deeply connected because it was essentially Googlers and their friends. And so the people I saw on Google Plus early were really relevant to me. And then the leadership at Google was like, okay, this is working great. Now we're going to open this up to the world. And this is maybe 2 months in and the product wasn't ready. Yeah. And we're going to open this up to everybody. And what that resulted in was a sparse network problem. So you would come into Google Plus, not being a friend of any Googlers or anyone on there, and the experience wouldn't mean anything to you.
Yeah.
You didn't know anyone. They weren't relevant to you. And so you churned pretty immediately. Yeah. So there's a great chapter here in the Cold Start Problem book about these Big Bang launches.
I love Google Plus.
Pardon?
I love Google Plus. I thought it was
It was kind of sad that didn't succeed.
It was like what you just mentioned, though. It's like, I feel like, and also for T2, I feel like early adopters are going to be tech nerds, right? Every tech nerd wants to get on the new platform and check it out. So I was able to find a family there right away, friends. Like everybody, once you see those invites go out, everyone's like, let's get on it. So you have those people, but of course that's not going to survive any sort of platform, right? You need regular people to use it on a daily basis.
Yeah, exactly. So Threads launched, deep breath, remember the Paul Graham essay. And then I started playing with it, and it's really blue check forward. So it is, we're going to take the existing Instagram network and we're going to feed Threads with that. And I was like, wow, this might actually work. And it kind of didn't. So I think populating it with blue checks and then having it be so brand heavy results in an experience where it's kind of the experience that you get if you join Twitter today, which is like, I don't understand how to win here. I don't understand how to build a following. I don't understand how to get from zero to some followers, because it seems like this is already populated by people who have won, and I'm never going to, how am I going to get to 200,000 followers on this thing?
Right.
So I think that was sort of like my hypothesis on after playing with Threads. And that's, I think, mostly worked out. So there was this leak recently that they have they lose about 70% of daily actives after about a week. So their retention is pretty lacking, I say. And I think it's going to be pretty interesting to see whether Facebook is going to keep investing in that, or if it's going to go the way of sort of like Hobby, which was their Pinterest clone, and TikTok, Lasso, which was their TikTok clone.
Right, exactly.
And Poke, which was their Snapchat clone.
Yeah.
I think they've invested more in this, so they're probably going to keep going.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I have way more questions for you, Gabor. This has been fascinating. I love talking to you. But I'm going to hand over and bring some of the startups that we have exhibiting at Web Summit to come and ask you. So these are the founders of startups that exhibit, and they have, you know, their early stage. So they also have a lot of questions for you. So I thought I'd pass the mic over to them. Gauthier, hey. On DeFi, how are you doing?
Hey, great. Great to be here. Great to hear you, Gabor. Very interesting.
What does OnDeFi do? Quickly, one sentence.
Yeah, so we enable Web2 users to get into DeFi by leveraging account abstraction and aggregation.
Okay, cool. What is your question for Gabor?
Yes, so Gabor, how do you see the decentralized social dApps Web3 landscapes, such as like Lens Protocol, who just raised $14 million? How do you see yourself this in the future?
Another social media platform.
Yeah, how do you position yourself in this?
Yes, we're not distributed. And I think we're going to keep going with the approach of a centralized social network because it's just much easier to do trust and safety in that environment. The handle ownership is clearer. Like there's only, it's not like KC at so-and-so Mastodon server or so-and-so Blue Sky server. So I think it's a little bit easier. There's also in the distributed space, there's Sparkcaster and Warpcast, for example, which has also raised a ton of money. But I think we want to do the centralized model because I think trust and safety is easier to do. And also once we get a little bit further, I think AI features are really much easier to do if you have all the data, you understand what people are looking at, you understand how to filter their content. So I think we're a little bit different. We're not really paying in that space.
What, I forgot to ask you this. What do you think of the Fediverse?
Like the Mastodon Fediverse.
Yeah, yeah. Because Threads is supposed to like link in with that too in the future, right? So it looks like that kind of platform is, I don't know, gaining some traction, I'm not sure.
It's so curious to me, but the accounts that, so what I've heard is that the Fediverse has about sort of like on the order of 5 million accounts, maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit less. Obviously, in the distributed context, a little bit harder to count them. Why would I, if I am Mark Zuckerberg or Adam Mosseri, want to federate with something that has far fewer accounts than I do? Because I have 100 million accounts on Threads. So maybe that plan will change. Maybe it will not. On the Fediverse, I think it is a really worthwhile effort, and I love what the Mastodon folks are doing. I think if I was a Mastodon instance operator, I've tried, there's a lot of burden that it puts on the individual operator around, especially trust and safety, but also like legal obligations around copyright or content that isn't allowed in your jurisdiction. Yeah. So I think that makes it just really hard to operate one of these instances.
Okay, cool. Gauthier, stick around. We'll come back to you for another question. Let's bring up our next startup, Miguel from GGDAB. Miguel, what does GGDAB do?
Hello. Thank you for having me here, and thank you both, Yara and Casey, for the great insights. GGDAB is a gaming platform and launchpad and a DeFi ecosystem focused on the indie game developers.
Okay. What question do you have for Gabor?
So my question is, with generative AI and tools like ChatGPT that are set to transform how we do business and the companies, and many say that in the future, unicorns won't have more than a couple of employees. Mm-hmm. How do you see this future, and how do you leverage this, and how do you, in a new company, go about hiring considering this?
Great question.
Yeah. Oh, I've been thinking a lot about this. Okay, so obviously have been playing with generative AI like probably everyone else here has. I think that the current models have sort of pretty obvious limitations that I wonder if they're gonna resolve, particularly around the, specifically, I think the context windows that are very limited on like GPT now has a 16K model. I don't have access to the Anthropic 100K token model yet. But let's say that those limits get removed. I think the dream of instead of you writing an iOS app for your new, or an Android app, hopefully, for your new startup, you just say, hey, AutoGPT, write me an app for my DApp platform, for example. That becomes possible. I think the current context windows are just too low, or at least the ones that I have access to. The second one is the knowledge cutoff, and this kind of interplays with the context window. So the knowledge cutoff of GPT is sometime in 2021. So it doesn't know anything that happened in the last year and a half. And so you have to feed it in via the prompt. Imagine that Twitter had been taken over by Elon Musk. It just doesn't know about that. So that is, so the context window and the knowledge cutoff are pretty important in kind of these generative AI models. I think it's going to change the way that we do startups once these limitations have been overcome. So there was an NFX essay a couple of days ago, and maybe that's the one you were referring to, Miguel, which was in the future, unicorns will have 3 employees who just know how to spin the plates of the AIs, and you don't really need more employees than that, and you can make multi-$100 million in revenue and be a unicorn startup. So I read that and I was like, wow, we hired too many people because we're 4 people in T2. And that was my first thought. And then my thought was immediately went to, well, if I have a 3-person unicorn startup, can I make it $2 billion by just hiring 3 more people? And of course I would hire those extra 3 people. So I think what this will, I think that the force multiplier of AI today is much smaller than it will be in the future when the models are more powerful. I don't think that humans are obsolete. I don't think that you will actually have a 3-person unicorn startup because you're just hiring more people and you become a decacorn startup.
Yeah, so, that's a good point.
But I do think that if you haven't taken classes in AI, like the Fast AI, Fast.AI, which is amazing, that's probably where I would start. You probably should, because it's such an important skill to have in the future.
I want to know, and in Bay Area, when you talk to your other founder friends, do people start to factor this in for hiring in 2024, 2025? Are they looking that far ahead, or are we all just still playing with it and seeing what it can do? Or is it actually on the roadmap for the next couple of years that, oh, we don't need that many people in 2025?
I've only heard the opposite.
Okay. Oh, interesting.
I need more AI engineers that really know how to use these models, and I need them right now. Apparently OpenAI is sort of like hiring like crazy because they have 1 million fires going on. Their product is taking off. So I see more people getting hired in the interim. But I think then, you need more skilled people that have skills in these AI technologies in the short term. I don't think we're at that inflection point. Eventually, maybe there will be an inflection point where you actually want fewer people, but I'm not seeing that being factored in today.
Okay. Good to know. Okay, that was a great question. Okay, let's bring up our third startup. Jason, how's it going, Jason?
Good. How are you? Great interview so far. This is great.
I know. This is fantastic, right? Super interesting. Okay, Jason, what does Chain Champs do?
So we are a blockchain cybersecurity company. Our mission is to build, deploy, and make accessible the world's most capable bot and scam detection system on blockchain.
Oh, okay. Great. What's your question for Gabor?
Okay, so my question is naturally about bots. So it's no secret that social media is infested with bots and scammers, people trying to make a quick buck. So, well, what are you doing to try to address this issue on your platform?
When we launch the API, we will have safeguards around this in place. There are, I'm thinking AI powered. We're not there yet, I think, because we don't have the API and we don't. I think there's maybe ways you can programmatically write posts on T2 today, but you would have to care enough about it, I think, to do it. I think this is a big problem on Twitter. And I mean, every time I open my DMs, it's sort of like half T2 related and half crypto scams, or like buy my token or et cetera. And what I think It has become a little bit less dramatic since Twitter basically took away a lot of the capabilities of their API. And now an API key that gives you what you could get for free 8 months ago gives you that for $100 is kind of the new place that we stand. I think that we have to find kind of the new balance between how do we make APIs accessible and make these social APIs useful. But how do we then fight the scammers and the spammers and the bots? I think we have to kind of get to a new balance. I don't know what that's going to look like yet.
You haven't had any of this problem yet because there's not enough. It's still closed. You don't have an open API or anything like that. So you're not seeing that. That's why everybody's so friendly still. I'm sure it was like this on Twitter in the first year too. Everybody was really friendly at the beginning as well, right?
One interesting thing that happened. Sorry, this just kind of random, but so these nudges that we introduced in the Compose experience have detached our growing post count with the reports count. So fewer pieces of content are getting reported because we do this kind of proactive nudging on helping you make posts that are less offensive. So I do think AI actually helps with a lot of this stuff, and maybe I'll report back in a year on how that all went.
Okay, great. Let's go back up to Gautier again. Do you have another question?
Yeah, sure, Gabriel. I'm thinking how you are going to attack your go-to-market strategy. What's your plan to compete with all these actors out there? It must be quite tough.
Well, so I think initially it was start small, and I had it's like email Paul Graham very early on. He was pretty skeptical of doing another Twitter, and I was like, okay, what advice do you have? And he said, start with your friends. And that has really worked out super well. Like launching to just six people on the first day was, in retrospect, a pretty good move rather than trying to do like the threat style launch, which has all the big bang launch problems. I think right now we're trying to grow by inviting people that are sort of proximate on the graph. So if you are on T2, occasionally we drop you invites and then you invite your friends. And that's our primary growth mechanism right now. And that's worked pretty well because people are still looking for an alternative to Twitter that is friendlier and maybe not owned by an unlikable billionaire. So I think that has worked pretty well. I think we need to get to a much more feature complete product where if you come in, you're not going to ask us the kind of obvious question. Like until last Tuesday, the first question we often got was, where are DMs? You don't have DMs. How is this really a thing? And so we need to make it more feature complete and keep walking the graph of getting kind of the proximate people that are already your friends onto the platform through this invite mechanism. One thing that has really served us well is doing this waitlist approach initially because we got tens of thousands of people on the waitlist. And then pulling from that allowed us to kind of grow the network. And they were all people who had heard about what T2 was from my initial tweet, which is how they got on the waitlist. So they already had some internal connectivity within themselves. I got warned by David Lee, but I'm not sure if he's a well-known, he started Google Photos at Google, and he was like, waitlists don't age well. So you typically see with waitlist, YC sees with waitlists about like 5 to 10% conversion, I believe is the number he quoted me. If you go through the waitlist later, we're seeing like 35%. So yeah, no, not everyone signs up who's on the waitlist, but much higher than expected conversion from the waitlist. I think it's because the topic of what's going to be next after Twitter has remained really du jour.
I think Gabor's main go-to-market strategy is to be the nice billionaire running social platform.
Not sure if I'm going to make it to the billionaire part,
Oh,
but
hopefully.
the nice part is for sure.
What? You're definitely a super nice guy. What about? I always think that people want to jump on social media platforms and sign up as soon as possible because they want to secure A, their name first of all, right? Like domain name squatters and name squatters on social are still big, right? And then as you know, as it gets bigger, we don't know which one's the big one in, especially for social media influencers. So they're going to want to get on there. Do you see that in the wait list? Do you see a lot of like people who are like popular on Instagram or on Twitter already trying to get their names secured on T2?
Oh yeah, for sure. Like the handle Landgrab is a big one. We're trying to counterbalance that by saying, okay, but if you have a really short handle, then and you go inactive, then we're going to bump you back to a backup handle. So if you use that link that was dropped earlier, the t2.social/i/collision next, which would allow you to sign up for T2 right now and claim your handle. If you enter a handle that's like four characters, we're going to tell you, this is great, but we're going to reclaim this handle if you go inactive.
Oh, okay.
Because we do want to set expectations around this not just being a naked like handle land grab, but also we want to have a viable social network with active accounts where I actually post them.
Okay. All right. We have a few minutes left, so let's go back to the startups. I'm sorry, guys. I keep taking your time. Miguel, what do you have another question?
My question is, what growth hacking advice could you give to early stage startups like ours, considering all your experience, not only on T2, but all other companies you founded? What is the most important advice that you could give us?
Yes, if you, this is like my favorite topic, I would obviously start reading this book, The Cold Start Problem. Maybe your cold start problem is already solved, so you wanna kind of grow from there. I have a Medium, medium.com/, I think I have Gabor, maybe I have my full name, Gabor Chella, where I have a sort of a rundown of, yeah, I do have that, Gabor, great. I'm on all of the Ev Williams started startups with my first.
Being name. In Silicon Valley, you're able to get on top of all these new platforms and get your name. That's great.
So I have two posts that I wrote during my Google times. One was 9 ways to build virality into your product, which gives you kind of a menu of options for virality. And then 11 ways to build retention into your product, which kind of splits it into things that are less spammy and things that are more spammy. And I think that's a pretty good starter for answering this question.
That's great. We just posted that into the feed, so everybody should see it now. If you can't see it, it's just medium.com/@Gabor. Jason. Final question, yep. Up to you. Let's sign it off. Go for it.
Okay, excellent. You touched a little bit on features that you're adding. So what new features are you most excited about adding to T2?
AI, everything AI. I think that's mostly what I'm playing with right now. The most requested features are an API and an app. So those are definitely on the waitlist. And I've tried to ask AutoGPT to write our app. I'm not sure if people are familiar with AutoGPT. It's basically a way for GPT to recurse into itself. So it's like, GPT, write me an iOS app for T2. And then it's like, here are the four steps you need to do. And then it's like, then it automatically asks GPT for the first step. Like, how do you do the first step? And it kind of recurses into itself. I think it's a brilliant, brilliant kind of new tool. The output is crap. The output is crap because of the context window limitations and because of the knowledge cutoff limitations that I was talking about earlier. So the technology is not yet there, but it is so important to get to like really get skilled up on this right now, because I think we're going to hit the inflection point where AutoGPT will actually become really useful. Once, especially the context window sizes are there.
At the beginning, you said Paul Graham's advice, just to launch right away and just iterate. How often do you guys release updates then? Is it like every day, every week? How fast do you guys work?
Every weekday. So
okay. Every weekday.
Yeah. So we on Saturday and Sunday, we initially were launching things on Saturday and Sunday, but you got to have some semblance of work-life balance. So that's why we're doing Monday through Friday now. So we kind of have, we structured into things that we can launch every day. So like smaller bugs, like little glitches that we fixed right away. And we have a set of developers working on the team is actually more than four because we also have contract developers. And then we have a list of longer ranging things, like for example, the DMs, which took about two months to build. That we're launching on, obviously, less frequently.
Okay, cool. Okay, Gauthier, Jason, and Miguel, you guys are all on T2, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yes. Great. Perfect. So anybody listening to us not on T2, you can sign up for it, and you'll have 5 friends immediately. We're all on it.
Amazing.
Was there. Gauthier, Jason, Miguel, thank you so much for coming on. We'll see you guys at Web Summit. Appreciate you being here. Gabor, cool. Thank you so much for your time, too. This has been super insightful. If you guys haven't seen it yet, there is a special invite link now to join T2, t2.social/i/collision next with 2 N's in it. Any last words, Gabor? Where are we going to see you next? Are we going to see you in Lisbon, or where are we going to see you next?
I was going to book my tickets yesterday, but I waited until today. So I'm going to see you in Lisbon as well.
Okay, awesome. So Lisbon in November, we're doing, here's some sales stuff for Web Summit. If you don't know, we're doing Qatar in February 2024. We have a flash sale right now at qatar.websummit.com if you want to join us in the Middle East. And then, of course, the Web Summit Lisbon tickets are increasing price soon, in actually 2 weeks. So if you're coming to Lisbon, anybody out there, definitely secure your spots now. Everybody, thank you so much, and we'll see you on the next stage.
All right. Bye.
Take care, guys.